call the committee, House Committee on Government Accountability and Information Technology to order for January 23rd, 2007. And I'm going to open an informational hearing, and it'll be on regulatory streamlining, and that hearing is open. So, Pat, if you would.
Thanks very much, Chair Ellie, members of the committee. My name is Patrick Allen, and I manage the state's Office of Regulatory Streamlining, which is a part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. What I'd like to do today really is three things: to give you a general background on the regulatory streamlining initiative that's been underway for about the past 4 years in the state, to talk a little bit about the accomplishments and some of the actions that have happened under that initiative, and then give you a little bit of an overview of the legislative package that state agencies are bringing forward to this session. Just by way of background, the initiative was kicked off with the governor's first executive order in 2003. And in that order, he directed state agencies to look at how they regulate business and find ways to make those regulations cheaper, faster, simpler, easier to understand, easier to comply with, without lowering the standards Oregonians expect for protecting consumers, workers, public health, public safety, and the environment. In other words, we didn't want to get into an exercise of, well, can we really afford this particular standard? That's a policymaker decision that you all and the executive branch work out. Given whatever those sets of standards are, what's the most effective and efficient way that we can deliver them that has the least impact necessary on the economy? He also directed state agencies to look at those who have to comply with their regulations as among their customers, to be sure agencies have lots and lots of customers, but to at least consider those who have to comply as one of them, to assess the satisfaction of those customers with their services, and then identify plans, tools, resources, ways to improve that customer satisfaction. He charged Corey Streisinger, my director, with overall responsibility for the initiative at Consumer and Business Services, because it's the state's largest business regulatory agency. She would be here providing this overview to you today, except she's down the hall at Ways and Means Committee having conversations with them right now, so she regrets not being able to be here. But the third thing he did was to create the Office of Regulatory Streamlining as a place to basically consolidate state efforts around this issue, provide tools, resources, suggestions, interact with businesses, and those kinds of things. And so we've been underway now, as I say, in March. It'll be 4 years. And I'd like to hit on some of the things that we've done over that time period to give you an idea of sort of the flavor of how agencies regulate. Now, people are going to at some point turn to the 87-page list of projects that we have there. I know it's kind of tempting to think, well, I have lots of pages of paper from the streamlining initiative. We did want to kind of give you a flavor of the fact that what there is a lot of stuff going on. Conversation I often have with agencies is we're not talking about necessarily streamlining things for your agency. We're really talking about streamlining things for the businesses that have to comply with your regulations. And sometimes that means asking agencies to consider issues they wouldn't have otherwise considered, asking them to undertake projects they might not have undertaken all by themselves, although often for most agencies, streamlining is something that is on their agenda in any case. But just, I guess, the preemptive strike on the 87-page report of projects. Let me hit then a few of the highlights that you're going to find in the written testimony and in this package of projects. Online access to government regulation has been a big element of the initiative. One of the keystones to that is our online directory of licenses and permits. This is a comprehensive listing available at licenseinfo.gov through the Oregon website. That has references to over 1,000 state licenses in a uniform, standardized format that makes it easy to find by keyword or by topic area or by agency information about how to comply with licenses. And in many cases, a business will tell you, I don't care so much about, what are the regulations, but tell me what I need to do to comply because I want to comply with the law. And so making it easy to find that information out is a key reason for doing this directory. Now, over the last 2 years, we've really come to recognize and act on the fact that our customers don't often think in neat little boxes of state government and local government and federal government. And so we've now expanded that license directory to include information on county, city, and special district licenses so that if you put in a keyword, you'll get back results not just in state government but in local government as well. And we're beginning to now add units of local government to that list. And as of about 2 weeks ago, we're now linking to federal licensing information. And so if you put in the phrase construction, you'll get back a large number of state licenses that impact construction. You'll get back a handful of local licensing information on construction. And of all things, you'll get a return from the federal government on FCC licensing. Now, this is a license directory, not a directory of all regulations. And so one of the things that the federal government licenses is the construction of radio and television transmitters. And so you get those kinds of returns. And so those kinds of pieces of information, combined with the fact that you can, in most cases, drill down to get information about individual licensees, we think makes this license directory the most comprehensive kind of its or directory of its kind anywhere in the country. Now, access to the licensing information, what do you have to do is a good step. But really, the ability to actually do business online, we think, is even better. The ability to find out what it is you have to do to comply and then go take those actions, register, renew your license, actually do the business. And that's also a growing area in state government, more and more elements of business that are available. The biggest push today, in this current session, building on an existing project, has to do with building permits. If you go out and get a building permit in a jurisdiction, especially in some of the metro areas around the state where there are licensing is done by multiple jurisdictions, a building permit for a project at a particular house on a particular street may require a building permit from one city and a plumbing license from a county and something from a different jurisdiction, and that's all really difficult to ferret out just based on the address. Most people in the construction business have somebody whose job is to do that stuff. If it's a big company, it's a permit expediting function. If it's a mom and pop, it's either mom or pop who are out running around from city hall to county courthouse pursuing those licenses. Today we have in place through the building codes division at DCBS a quick permit system that for participating jurisdictions, and there are about 8 or 10 of them right now, lets you put in the address of the property, put in the nature of the project, and it'll calculate the fees, ask you the relevant questions, figure out who the jurisdictions are, let you put in your Visa or MasterCard number, send the money to who it needs to go to, and on your desktop you print out the actual license. Now these are for simple projects where you don't have to do plan review, but it lets you do the whole thing right there and then start the project. And it lets you do the whole thing if you're doing this quote for somebody on a Saturday and the relevant government offices aren't open, so you can start work right away or first thing on Monday. And in fact, one of the things we're finding is that the number of these permits has gone up significantly, and so by making it easier to do business, we think we get actually more compliance with the licensing requirements. You're going to see the second wave of that this legislative session. Building codes and the governor have a program option package to basically build the next stage of that, which is a comprehensive online licensing system that does handle plan review and allows for beginning to end electronic processing comprehensively of building permits that should be able to allow jurisdictions that participate to save and their applicants primarily to save huge amounts of time, confusion, and error and those kinds of things in the processing of those permits. To assist agencies with the overall issue of online transactions, Department of Consumer and Business Services, working with Administrative Services, have entered into a statewide license for off-the-shelf online licensing software. It's a package. One package allows for the management of license information. A related package allows for the online interface with customers. And so any agency that wants to pursue that kind of activity doesn't have to go out with a request for proposals and go select its own software. They can still do that if they've got particular needs that make that the best thing to do, but right now there's an off-the-shelf, already licensed, already paid-for package that they can simply begin to make use of, and we've assisted with that process through promotion, user groups, and those kinds of things. Next area I'd like to touch on is the 87 pages of single agency projects. I guess sort of half tongue in cheek, I tell people the Office of Regulatory Streamlining doesn't streamline anything. It's the agencies that do the regulation that do the streamlining. And what you find here is a compendium of, by last count, 339 projects in 37 different state agencies that do a variety of things from really complicated and interesting to, I'll even say, the majority really simple and overwhelmingly dull. One of the things we found in the streamlining initiative is there, in the main, aren't these big, huge terrible regulatory processes that, you know, nobody cares about but somebody operating some program in some hidden building somewhere. And that all we had to do was kind of shine a light on them and we'd be able to go fix them and they'd be big and sexy and interesting. Most of it is nitty-gritty, individual, little pieces of efforts that needed to happen at different agencies. Great example from a couple of years ago, the Board of Chiropractic Examiners. They license chiropractors. Chiropractors are responsible for doing continuing education. And every time their license came up for renewal, those chiropractors would package up written documentation of all the continuing education they'd taken and ship it into the Board of Chiropractic Examiners. Well, processing that paper was an issue for the chiropractor, keeping track of it, getting it all sent in and in the right order. Dealing with it when it came in was an issue for the agency, and the question became, well, is this really effectively protecting anybody? The agency was able to determine that they could get the paper out of the system, still require that chiropractors do continuing education and keep records of it, but get the paper out of the system in terms of license renewal, subject a percentage of the chiropractors to an audit so that you were making sure that people were actually doing that work, but you could simplify the whole transaction, make the system less costly for the agency, less costly for chiropractors, and still maintain public protection. Now, I go through that in about 30 seconds and people's eyes begin to immediately glaze over. There's nothing really exceptionally sexy about that kind of a story. And when you look through here and flip through these pages, you're going to see lots of those kinds of things. On the other hand, there are stories in here that are really very, very interesting. Trucking Online is a great example. Again, to the standards issue, reasonable people can have lots of arguments about the weight mile tax, but keeping track of weight mile records is a serious issue for people who have to do it. Through Trucking Online, they've been able to take that intensive paper system, as well as everything about registration and titling and anything that you have to deal with Department of Transportation in the trucking business, and get the paper out of that system, computer to computer data transactions, online payments, and all those kinds of things. Literally tens of thousands of sheets of paper per year wrung out of the system through a project that is actually kind of big and sexy. Really what they're about is the cumulative impacts of all those kinds of issues. It's not any one project that's going to fix things and everybody's going to say, oh, you know, the state's wonderful. But as we accumulate, I think it was 225 projects 2 years ago, it's 339 projects now, we take ever larger or ever more bites at the problem and begin to really find ways that we can wring inefficiencies out of the regulatory system. Let me move quickly from single-agency projects to multi-agency projects, and this is would really describe, I think, a lot of what the office itself has done in the past 2 years. These are projects where the problem isn't one agency running one system that really needs to look differently at how it operates. It's where a customer has to deal with multiple agencies on a single topic. The system doesn't work as well as anybody would like it to, but no one agency really owns the problem. Let me give you a couple of examples. A really complicated example we're still dealing with. If you're in any kind of a commercial or residential development project where you're going to build something, you're likely to deal with wetlands issues. You're likely to need to deal with the Department of State Lands and a whole bunch of other agencies because of the fact that you're dealing with the Department of State Lands. And that system can be very complicated to understand. It can be difficult or frustrating to find out early in the process what you need to do to comply. You can learn about an agency well down the road that you needed to deal with, and all of a sudden you think you're pretty close to done and a new issue crops up. We've been working with about a half a dozen state agencies over the last interim to put together a package of changes to try to see if we can't make that system deliver clearer information up front for people for what they need to do to comply, a better way of resolving conflicts and getting those issues dealt with, and a quicker, hopefully, process. None of that deals with the standards you have to comply with. Those all remain the same. The issue is, how do we get that information to someone who wants to do a project quicker, and how do we make sure the problems that are going to crop up early and can be dealt with at the design stage or early in the process and not at the 11th hour when you're ready to move on a project and suddenly can't. Second project that we spent some time working on, learned a lot, and ended up doing something rather different than we expected. I think Representative Thatcher's heard this story. What I now think is the most regulated business in the state of Oregon is running the local Circle K. If you're running a convenience store and sell the usual portfolio of packaged food, beer, wine, cigarettes, you have a gas pump out front, you do those usual things, there are 12 different state agencies that license, audit, inspect, regulate, or in some way care about what you do. Now, each one of them makes a great deal of sense. The Department of Agriculture makes sure that the mojos in your deli counter aren't going to kill people, at least quickly. OLCC is going to license the sale of beer and wine through your store. DEQ cares, Department of Environmental Quality cares about whether you have underground storage tanks. Each one of those things makes sense and generally is done pretty straightforwardly and efficiently by those agencies. And yet, at the end of the day, you layer each of those 12 things on top of each other, and you end up with this really complicated set of regulations and agencies that a business has to deal with. Last session, the legislature authorized a pilot project to look at one element of that problem, the annual licensing that a number of those agencies do, and authorized a pilot project to work on fixing that. And so we worked with the Liquor Control Commission, Environmental Quality, and Agriculture, each of which had some kind of a transaction where you would get some forms, you'd fill out some paperwork, you'd write a check, and you'd send it back in. And over the course of a year, that was about 15 pages worth of paperwork you would do between the three agencies, often with the same information, who owns the business, what's the business's address, those kinds of things. And we worked on a system where we could send them one set of paperwork once a year. We got it down, I think, to 3 pages. You'd write one check, you'd fill it out one time and send it back in. We learned a couple of interesting things. We did it as a very small-scale pilot to see what it would take to do that on a large scale. We learned, not surprisingly, that the businesses who have to comply loved it. We also learned that the technological differences between the agencies were so vast that we couldn't roll that out, at least immediately, on any kind of a wide scale. You had one agency that was, fairly leading edge in terms of automated licensing systems. You had another agency that was keeping licensing records on 3x5 hand-typed index cards. And the ability of those kinds of systems to talk to each other and be able to do some kind of a combined system was just nil. The pilot ended up being a hand-done system that you couldn't replicate to scale. Well, through that, we were able to get a technology package for the one agency. The other agencies are beginning to improve their technology, and so we hope that by about next year, Environmental Quality and Agriculture will be able to pursue a project where they jointly license, and we think we'll be able to work with Liquor Control Commission a little later as they roll out their technology. But it was a great learning experience for us in terms of what are the real day-in and day-out barriers of doing these things that you would strike you as sort of real obvious, and why don't we just do that, and begin to learn some of the barriers to why you just don't do that. Before I turn to the legislative package, let me just hit training and tools real quickly. Part of what the office does is to work with agencies in terms of what are the things that they need to know or look for, or how can we help them do a better job of some of these elements of regulation. In the area of administrative rules, we've been very active together with Department of Justice and Department of Administrative Services in providing ongoing training each year, literally to hundreds of agency staff who are involved in that rule development process, and we're able to stress things like fiscal impact statements. We had some major legislation through Representative Thatcher last session that dealt with that. Use of advisory committees and making sure agencies are doing that really when and where they can. How they deal with public comment, how they deal with who and how people find out about legislation. We actually, in the Office of Regulatory Streamlining, and I say we, I'm the Office of Regulatory Streamlining. It's a one-person office, and I've got some really great access to shared services at Consumer and Business Services, but I don't want to create an image that there's, a vast Department of Government Simplification or something like that. But what we're able to do is when the Oregon Bulletin comes out every month, we're able to look at all of the proposed rules and look and see what are agencies doing that might have an impact on business, and then actually pull those rule notices and look at the fiscal impact statements they did, the descriptions of the rules, and figure out, help coach agencies through that process of how do you adequately deal with some of those kinds of issues. Let me wrap up before I take some questions and talk quickly about legislation. You may recall last session we collectively, the agencies, had a package of over 30 bills, 29 of which passed and were signed by the governor. I'd like to think that helped kind of prime the pump for other streamlining ideas, and all told about 100 bills passed last session that, again, in some way made business regulations cheaper, faster, simpler, without lowering standards. Again, this session we have a package of 31 bills through, I think, a dozen agencies. You're going to hear a couple of them today. And again, these are bills much like the projects that that are not necessarily really sexy, and you'll read them and you think, oh, well, this will solve everything. And again, this is in a context of 339 other efforts that agencies have been able to do under their own authority. So lots and lots of things agencies can simply go work on. These are the areas where they've come to a problem that they want to fix, where they actually need statutory change. You're going to hear House Bill 2077 today from the Landscape Contractors Board that deals with the ability of a landscape contractor to hire a carpenter to build a deck, for example. And I don't want to steal Mike's thunder on that bill, but straightforward stuff that it's the law that ends up being the problem. Great example, another bill I think you're going to get, House Bill 2227. If you are a polygraph examiner in the state, you're licensed to do polygraph examinations, and there's a requirement that you file with the county clerk in the counties that you do business. To the extent I understand, nobody at the county particularly cares that you're doing business as a polygraph examiner. No one's going to the county clerk to figure out who's licensed to do business as a polygraph examiner in our county. They go to public safety standards and training for that. But everybody has to do it because that's what statute says you have to do. And so we're gonna eliminate that requirement. Similarly, last session we had three or four bills where agencies had the expiration of a license in their statute. This license expires December 31st of every odd-numbered year, whatever the case might be, which puts this big bubble in their workload. They have to process all of the licenses all at one time. And what you'd find is if you're trying to do that, you shape your agency's work around that. And as always happens, someone comes in on the day before the license expires when everybody else's licenses are expiring. They got some problem that you need to troubleshoot. And if everybody's there on the same day, your ability to do that troubleshooting and provide good customer service goes down. A number of agencies last session brought individual bills in to give them the ability to set that date and rule. Birth month is often how it's done. There are a number of ways to go about doing that. Those hearings generally took anywhere from 30 to 45 seconds. They were simple, easy. The legislature loved them and said, gee, we'd like to see more of that. So, again, back to the issue of paper, you're going to see a 70-page bill this session where we worked with legislative counsel to find every reference to a date in statute and basically say it can be that date if that's what they like, or they've also got the ability to change the date by rule to something that makes more sense. And so that's kind of the nature of the sorts of things you'll see from us on the streamlining package. With that, I know I've kind of flown really fast and low over a bunch of stuff, but I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Representative Greg. Thank you, Chair Riley. I actually have done some development, and I commend you on trying to consolidate some of the agencies that we deal with. Wetlands was something I dealt with, and I just very briefly, the Corps of Engineers and Division of State Lands spent months trying to agree on where to put the little red flags as to the wetlands. And I think it was 6 months, and after they finally agreed, the new Department of Agriculture came in and said they didn't have jurisdiction, the Department of Agriculture had jurisdiction, and he wanted to put them somewhere totally else. The Corps and the Division of State Lands said, fine, let him do that, but you have to mitigate. So let him put it where it is, but we're going to move him right back after he leaves the property. So, I mean, is that sort of scenario that I think gets us in trouble with government? And the question that I would have is when there's a federal agency overseeing certain things, like the Corps oversees wetlands, why do we even need the Division of State Lands, and why do we need the state involved? And that goes with Fish and Wildlife, state, and feds as well. And let you answer that question, and maybe if we can go off in that direction.
Sure. Chair Riley, Representative Grodd. The federal and state regulation issue, it kind of takes a couple of different flavors, as I'm sure you know. Places like Department of Environmental Quality, largely what they're doing is enforcing delegated federal authority. So you've got one federal set of standards, but it's a state agency that enforces them, and people generally seem satisfied with that as opposed to the alternative of federal regulation. There are a couple of areas, and wetlands is one, where state policymakers, going back a number of decades now, have made the decision that there should be a separate set of state regulations in addition to the set of federal regulations. And in regulatory streamlining, that would be one of those kind of areas where, given that, that collectively policymakers have made the choice that that's the way things are going to be, my job is to work with agencies to figure out how that system can operate as effectively and as efficiently as it can. If you were to make a different kind of a policy choice, that would be a different matter. But those are that's the policy deck that we're dealt, and so we've tried to work within that to figure out how can that system be as effective as it possibly can be.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Edwards.
Thank you. So it sounds like you're making a lot of good progress, and it's probably a fairly gratifying work to make progress on things that really touch a lot of Oregonians' lives, especially in the business community. But there's also always new stuff developing in government and in regulatory agencies and whatnot. Are you making progress? Is the inventory of stuff that needs to be done by your office, is that shrinking, or is it actually just growing and growing and growing?
Chair Eiley, Representative Edwards, thanks. That's a great question. Let me start off by saying we've always envisioned the Office of Regulatory Streamlining as a fairly limited duration. We go in, we do some work, we begin to work on changing culture, and then we go away, as opposed to, say, the New York Governor's Office of Regulatory Reform that's been there for about 14 years and has a staff of 50 people now. You could turn this approach or this issue into sort of a full-time permanent piece of the bureaucracy, and we'd really like not to do that. So a couple of things about that. Fundamentally, we think the job is about culture change. How do we get agencies to look at their regulatory mission just a little bit differently so that a part of what they're doing, again, back to that issue of those who have to comply are customers, how do they incorporate that notion and incorporate issues of economic impact into the fundamental mission they have to protect consumers, workers, public health, safety, the environment? Secondly, we're trying to build skills and tools and those kinds of things into agencies so that we can at some point get to a place where we feel like we've done some enabling at some of the key agencies that do an overwhelming amount of the regulation. And then third, there is sort of an element of what we do that I guess, for lack of a better phrase, I'd say is playing defense. Again, looking at those proposed rules to work with agencies, and once we've worked with an agency a couple of times to say, hey, have you thought about this or have you looked at that? Then they begin to think of that and look at that on their own. Similarly, during the legislative session, in the last couple of sessions, there have been legislative proposals for regulation where we've asked some questions and raised the notion of, well, do we really need to do this? Or two sessions ago, and there was a proposal to have state licensing of interior designers. And they had, lots of interesting arguments about why that was a really important for public health and safety thing to do. And, at the end of the day, the question was, well, is that really what it's about, or is it really about creating barriers to entry and more fundamental economic issues between businesses and industry? And so playing defense, I think, helps us keep that stack from getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Are we able to, get ourselves to the point where we've worked the stack down to nothing and say, well, our work is done here and everything's perfect? That's probably not realistic, but I think we can make some changes in culture and direction and then stop.
Thank you. I have a couple of questions. You mentioned at least twice agencies who choose to participate. And I wondered what we can do to help the agencies in the state, the counties and cities and water districts and so on, what we can do to encourage them to participate.
Well, thanks very much, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, and that was in reference to local government. Of course, state agencies, early on I was fond of pointing out to people that streamlining was, after all, executive order number one. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we had to have some fairly direct discussion with agencies, but state agencies have certainly participated and generally happily and very willingly. Our approach to local government has been more of offering assistance and offering a value and encouraging them to participate. And so the two areas where I think I used that participating agency example were in, or language were in, the license directory and in the quick permits and online building permits systems.
Mm-hmm.
We think that the most effective way to do that is to provide something that on its face provides a better way of doing business or improved customer service or an attractive tool to use, as opposed to coming in with some sort of a mandate where we say, you know, you have to do it this way or something bad will happen. For one thing, you get into a big fight about the mandate rather than focusing on what's the work that needs to get done. And we think we're able to, again, back to that culture change issue, if you're able to offer good tools, you're able to have a different kind of conversation with a local jurisdiction about how do you serve your customers and what's the most effective way for us to deal with the joint mission we have of someone who wants to do a particular kind of business and we're both regulating some element of what it is. How can we best help them know what those things are and comply with them?
And sort of a follow-up on that, as a one-person shop, how do you actually get out and talk to all these folks, and how long do you think it's going to take you to talk to all the agencies in the state?
Of course, we've been interacting with state agencies from the very beginning, and so, you know, through email, participation in the various communication vehicles that exist for dealing with agency heads and those kinds of things. That's fairly direct. Use the time-honored tactic of answering a question different than the one that you asked, which is to say the real big challenge is interacting with businesses out there and trying to get really good, solid input from business about what are the things we should be working on. It's really easy to get a business person to say regulations are killing me. It was surprising to us how hard it was after that to ask, well, so say more about that. What kinds of regulations? What can we fix? What can we work on? And come back to the convenience store example. And the problem for the convenience store, it was a convenience store owner out in Hermiston who talked with me for about an hour and a half one afternoon, kind of going through that stuff. It's a little bit like, you know, the kid's game of pickup sticks, and you're sort of asking the business owner to pick up a stick and say, this one. If you were to fix this one, I'd be happy, and the pile of sticks wouldn't be as burdensome. When really often we've got to kind of do some intuitive thinking of our own of if the problem is, well, it's all this regulation, what's that mean, and kind of dig down through that. That's turned out to be fairly challenging in this initiative.
Okay. And one other question, a whole different topic. The problem of different agencies, state agencies, with different not only levels but types of technology. What are we doing to approach that and get common technology that can actually work together?
Overall, that's a better question for Department of Administrative Services, I would say, than for me. My issue is not so much the underlying technology, but the functionality. To do streamlining, you need agencies to really have comparable capability, or at least the ability to, as you say, share information and data and those kinds of things. And there are examples in state government today where it works because they're on the same platform, and there are also examples where they're not on the same platform at all, but it can work. And so that's really the approach I've taken.
Any other questions? Thank you very much,
Thank
Patrick.
You.
And so I'm going to close that hearing, and I'm going to open an informational hearing on audits, and I'm going to ask the representative from the Secretary of State's office to come forward.
Good afternoon, Chair Riley and committee members. My name is Chuck Kibner. I'm the director of the Audits Division. Thank you for having us here, having me here, I guess. There's no us at the moment. To talk about what it is that we do, you'd ask that we give an overview of how we view ourselves, how it fits with the governance model for the state, and with six audits bills floating around there, three of which will be starting on the House side and three of which will be starting on the Senate side. Hopefully the discussion we have today will give a little bit of perspective and maybe answer some of the questions in advance of why these bills may be important to us. I've got a presentation today. In deference to the last half of your committee's name, IT, I figured we could put together a PowerPoint here and kind of walk through the division. We've got three primary objectives of the presentation, and this is a scaled-down version of one that we have presented in the past, and hopefully I didn't scale it down too far. If you have any questions, feel free to interrupt me during the presentation. That we'll be covering quite a bit of ground here, so if something strikes you, feel free. First thing we talk about is who we are and what our vision for ourselves is. Talk a little bit about how we provide information to folks like yourselves as well as some of our other customers, and also take a moment at least to look forward to what we perceive some of the challenges are around auditing in general and our office in particular. And the fourth objective I would have is that by the end of the discussion you'd at least have be as excited about auditing as I am. I know that's a far reach, but we'll see what we can do. Kind of the civics 101, where we see ourselves fitting in the whole fiscal control model. Legislature, of course, is the budget authority. The governor does the controlling function. The treasurer is the state's banker, and we are the auditor of public accounts, and the independent auditor of public accounts. That comes from the Constitution. The only mention there is of it is in relation to the Secretary of State being the, by virtue of his office, is the auditor of public accounts. There isn't any more guidance than that. So during past sessions, there has been some discussion as to what that means, you know, what sorts of tasks fit into that kind of general description of what an auditor might be. And we've gone to territorial statutes, or DOJ has gone to kind of the territorial statutes to help us define it a little bit. The financial audit role, the opinion audits is pretty clear. When you get to some of the other accountability issues, it may not be quite as clear. And that's where kind of where the discussion has gone. And you see, when we do look at some of the territorial statutes and what was envisioned when this first was put into the Constitution, and the role that they saw the auditor fulfilling, this is what they put in the territorial statutes, that one of the missions would be for lessening the public expense, promoting frugality, which is a term that I really love, the auditors of frugality. That's a great term. And economy and public office, better management, and more perfect understanding of fiscal affairs. So at least in our minds, we certainly see where there was the blessing to look a little beyond the standard opinion audits into some of the economy and efficiency and frugality issues that were out there at that time and also in our time. One of the examples we like to cite, just to say that, you know, the more things change, the more they stay the same. One of the first audits that the territorial auditor, B.F. Bonham, did was taking a look at penitentiary inmates and came to the conclusion they should be working. They should be providing something back, which I know we've had our own measures around that. So it's an ongoing issue. Our legal authority, we're the only independent organization with the constitutional audit authority over all three branches of government. That's quite a burden. We got 72 FTE and 120 some odd agencies, so it's quite a task to try to cover that in a reasonable way. And we'll talk a little bit further in the discussion about how we kind of approach that task and how we kind of drill down to what it is that we feel we should be doing and other things that it's more of a discretion. This is what we do. Our stated mission is auditing to protect the public interest and improve Oregon government. Let's see. Roles of audits. Some of the questions that we will be defining. When we talk about what is an audit, one of the things we talk about is objectively obtaining and evaluating evidence. You can talk about that in terms of audits. You can talk about that in terms of good management practices. You can talk about that in terms of internal audits. You can talk about doing that in a lot of different ways. But certainly, from an audit point of view, objectively attaining and evaluating evidence is primary. And communicating the results, finding a way to make yourself understandable, finding a way to be convincing when you're talking to folks about what you think a problem is and what you think a good fix would be. Being convincing and communicating clearly is critically important. Why we have audits is to facilitate that accountability. We are one of the parts in the accountability model for the state of Oregon, as are yourselves, as are agency directors, as is the governor's office. I mean, you can list a bunch of folks who play a role in accountability. And it provides that independent assessment. We are outside of the structure of an agency's governance. So even though internal audits are critically important, managers doing what they need to do in terms of evaluating their functions and making improvements is important, this is the independent assessment of a lot of those things. So the independence is huge for us. Levels of accountability, if you just kind of want to talk in terms of, not necessarily stair steps, not that one is more important than the other, but just kind of as definitions, you've certainly got compliance as an issue, making sure that operations are in compliance with laws and regulations. Management accountability, holding the managers accountable for how they're allocating and managing their resources. Performance accountability, the efficiency questions that around delivering a service. Program effectiveness, something I know you folks are very interested in when you budget money to a program. Are we getting what we're being promised we're going to be getting? And also the policy accountability, what choices are being made in a particular operation around what policies they think are important to implement, all of them, none of them, part of them, which ones, what trade-offs there are. Again, a little different level of accountability. Audit's role in accountability, it is, again, to provide that credible information. In its base form, I guess, is just applying the scientific method. You know, asking a question that's important to be asked and then finding the way to answer it in a way that's objective. So you are objectively obtaining evidence and reporting the results to stakeholders. One of our requirements under our government auditing standards as the independent auditor is to report things publicly. So all of our reports are on our website, and we send out notices. Hopefully you folks get them. If not, let me know. I'd love to add you to the list. But you're supposed to be getting notices when we do release reports. And that's all a part of the model of being open and public with our audit results. Audit environment, who are our customers? Well, that's a kind of a complicated question. And you think Walmart has problems trying to figure out who their customers are and what they want. We've got a little bit of a model here, too, where we're depending upon, in many cases, the topic we're auditing. For our financial audits, we've got a certain customer base. For performance audits and maybe just particular topics or particular agencies, there's different groups that are interested in things. But those are the sort of people that we're considering as we're releasing reports and writing reports as to who we're trying to communicate to. Let's see, we've got to the legislature there in big, bold letters. That was by design. I wanted to impress upon you that we do care. Investors and creditors, CPA firms. We do have a municipal auditing function where we work with local CPA firms around the Municipal Audit Act and making sure that the small municipalities and districts are reporting in a way that meets standards. Governor, of course, state agencies, local governments, the federal government, and taxpayers, of course, is our broadest one. What can we do to work better with the legislature? We, over the past few years, we've really strived to create a better linking with the legislative branch, and it's in particular the Joint Legislative Audit Committee, in trying to get requests for our types of service kind of filtered down to one organization or one grouping who can kind of help us triage and rank what it is that is important for us to try to undertake and provide information to you folks. Past years we've gotten a variety of requests for audit work, some actual audit topics, some not, but we appreciate getting that input. But it's very difficult for us if we're trying to respond to interest from a legislator as to whether that one over there is as important as that one over there. So we're trying very hard to help fashion a model that really helps us determine what is important to you folks. And so as you pose the questions, we certainly will take direct calls. My number's in the book. Just call. I'll be happy to answer. But you've also got your Legislative Audit Committee during the interim, and I'm not exactly sure how it's handled in session. But certainly if you have something of particular interest, communicate it, and I'd be happy to chat with you about it. And this, of course, is
what we're evaluating is whether it can be of value to decision makers as well as the governor, local agencies, and local governments. Auditing has traditionally, and maybe not to all you folks as you've been around a while, but traditionally been thought of a kind of a hindsight sort of activity. You know, it's we're opining on financial statements or spending activities or something that's happened in the past. With the way things have changed, and you can certainly see from Thomas Maynard, president of the OFCPA, back in 97, 98, and I did contemplate trying to get more recent quotes, but it's probably as current now as it was then, that we are in an information profession, both forward-looking and backward-looking, trying to communicate to agencies or whoever we happen to be auditing that future, them looking forward and instituting controls or having a pattern to continue to improve controls is important, and us to be able to help them evaluate that and help them implement those sorts of things is probably as important as a lot of the other things that we do. And as technology is becoming more, as it proliferates, and it's becoming not just something that we utilize, but something that we now have to audit in more detail. We're finding that the business risks associated with new technology are less understood and therefore much greater than probably a traditional paper and pencil sort of process. So we've had to get smarter in that regard. And that's a risk not just for the agencies, but it's a risk for us because we're taking on the role of providing good information back on technology risks as well as some of the other risks that may be out there. How do we decide where to audit? Frequently asked questions. Why are you auditing us? Did we do something wrong? How do we get so lucky? That was always a good one. And if we never do it again, will you promise to go away? Those are all valid questions. The answer to the last one is, well, maybe. Almost everything we do is, we call it risk-based. For the last 15, 20 years, you may have heard in relation to audits, risk-based auditing. And really, that's just taking a little more systematic look at what risks are out there, how risks are being managed, coming up with some sort of both a preliminary estimate, evaluation of how risky a particular thing or process is, and then using that information to triage what's important to look at. A couple of the things we do are not risk-based. They're statutorily mandated. So if we had a chance to put it in the risk queue, it may have been more risky when the law first got on the books and may not be quite as risky now. And that may be by virtue of the fact that there was a law on the books and we were asked to audit it, and now we've kind of moved a distance in terms of controlling that activity, that it's less risky now than ever before. One of the things that we are mandated to do are the change of director audits or reviews. We've got a constitutional requirement to look at Measure 66 funds, the expenditure of the Fish and Parks funds. When Senate Bill 1, the Youth Authority Bill, was first passed, there was a mandate in there for us to look at the reporting and how well we were doing with youth corrections. And so you can see those sorts of things aren't necessarily work we do by virtue of it being risk-based. It's mandated, and of course we do it. But in particular with like the change of director audits, we've been doing a lot of them now, and reviews, and the risk we see is diminishing. And one of the components of one of the bills you may look at, starting in the Senate, is that whole idea of whether the change of director review should be mandated or not. It may be a case where if we had a little more flexibility, there'd be a lot of that work we wouldn't do, which would free up resources to do others. But if truly it was a risky situation, a situation we should be looking at, we would. We would still have the ability to do that. So if and when that makes it over here, I'm sure we'll have a little more discussion on that. And there's a case to be made on either side. Maybe the reason it's low risk is because there is a mandate, then we'll be looking. I mean, it's all a part of that discussion. I certainly understand that. Okay, so back to why and where we audit. In its base form, risk is just the chance that something adverse will happen. Risk is a chance of loss. Risk is all around us. We can't hope to defeat it. We can only hope to contain it. So we certainly recognize that things will not always go right. One of the components of risk is just the inherent risk, the risk that exists just because something is, because we are doing something. It creates a certain amount of risk. Cash is risky no matter how you handle it. Lots of cash is riskier than a little bit of cash, unless you're a small store where a little bit of cash is really important to you, then you may view it a little differently. So you can see risk just exists. And some of the things we look at when we're thinking of inherent risk is size of budgets, number of federal programs, number of people, complexity of the organization, and turnover, which for the past 10 years, turnover has been something that has I think, really added to the risk model because it's been difficult for the state as a whole to keep the knowledge in the agencies and working hard on these programs. Control risk is what managers are expected to have in place to help control risk. Like I said, they can't hope to eliminate it. You just can hope to control it. To mitigate such things as financial flows, information technology, weak management, programs not accomplishing goals, what are they doing to ensure that those risks are minimized, that those sorts of things are, that they're getting that sort of certainty that things are going to go how they expect them to go. And that's, as I stated before, I got a little ahead of myself. Management controls is simply how do they mitigate that risk. And, of course, you too can be an auditor if you just kind of ask these three questions and take a couple years of accounting and management and pass the CPA test and all these other things. You too can be an auditor. First question, what could go wrong that would prevent a program from achieving its intended objectives? What could go wrong if you're looking at a particular program? Could be providing services to the wrong people, licensing homes that don't meet the requirements, paying for things you shouldn't, building bridges that don't meet specifications, developing systems that aren't without an appropriate life cycle methodology, which means you're probably developing a system that has a chance of not being quite what you had in mind. So what is kind of the next question. You've identified that there is a problem, potentially. What would be the effect if something did fail? Well, lost dollars, health and safety, maybe federal funding would be jeopardized, providing services to clients who didn't need them, and so on. Third thing you ask is kind of what would you be expecting them to do to help mitigate these things? Could the manager have protected this from occurring? And some of the things that you might find in place or might not is clear policies, adequate training, some management reviews, and maybe some performance measures, which clearly spell out what we're going to be tracking, what they're supposed to be attaining, and hopefully they're monitoring those things. This gets a little more to what services we provide. We break it down into a couple different audit categories. We do our financial audits. We do our performance audits. We do some compliance work, information technology, and then we do the special investigations related to the hotline function. Financial auditing is financial reporting. We also have a component that looks at internal controls and also compliance with rules and regulations. And the goal is to provide an independent assessment of financial reporting that improves public accountability and facilitates decision making. These are primarily financial statement audits that we're ensuring when we express an opinion, we're making sure that everything is in there and reported, at least materially reported, as it should be and is following generally accepted accounting principles. And then again, do policies and procedures assure transactions are recorded, processed, clarified, summarized, and reported properly, all feeding into that financial statement. And then did the agencies comply with the financial-related legal requirements? There is a component of every financial audit that looks at the legal requirements that they're expected to follow, and we'll have an assessment of that in there as well. So as you're reviewing, I know you'll all be reviewing all of our opinion audits now, but as you're reviewing those are the things you could expect to both see and feel, and you know that we're, when we do give you our opinion, that's the sort of thing that we're attesting to or we'll be disclosing aren't quite up to standards. Information technology. We broke it out into general control application control of securities. When in our infancy in 95 and 96, we used to do a component of IT, which was called a general controls review, where we would look at system development, look at backup and recovery, look at change management, kind of the general controls, and then even some access controls. We kind of rolled those now into an application control review, which gets to the integrity of the data, as well as those other controls, which lead to whether the data can be considered to have integrity. The part that we've ramped up a lot in the last two biennia is the security work we've done. We've really taken a proactive approach at getting more training so we can drill down into some of these areas of security and information technology security that allows us to evaluate router configuration, platform configuration, access management issues at a more granular level. So we're trying to get smarter about those sorts of things so we can provide good recommendations and also provide a better testament to some of the systems we do audit as to whether or not they're meeting standards. And again, it's an independent assessment. Let's see. This describes a little bit about the general application part of it. It's a software application being processed, system development life cycle, physical security, logical security. See how many of these I got, backup and recovery. Are controls adequate with the application to ensure integrity of the output? That's ultimately what we're looking to find out, is whether the information is good going in, processing, and coming out. Whether access is at a granular enough level so that they can give it on a least privileged basis. Whether it's transaction level authority, which just is again that more granular level of access. Data integrity checks and calculation accuracy, probably more than you'll ever want to know about information technology audits, and et cetera, which covers the rest. Let's see. What we're hoping to do with these things is look at whether an agency's established security over the sort of things that I mentioned before. And when we're doing security audits, one of the things that you may need to know is that because of the sensitive nature of some of our security findings, they are protected by ORS 192.501, a couple subsections there that in the general report, we will disclose that there is a security report that is protected, but just so folks know that we have done the work, it just needs to maintain confidential so it's not open for public consumption and allow some black hat hacker to go out and find a way into some of our systems. We certainly don't want to be facilitating that.
I'm going to ask you if you can maybe speed it through this just a little bit, wrap it up in about 5 minutes or so.
I can do that. Our performance audit function, we do evaluate economic and efficiency issues. We'll look for agency. Let's see. We can get through these ones. Some potential, some of the things that would lead to, just things that necessarily do or equip for. In our performance audit function, what we really do is look at risk, and we'll be twice a year we go through and we take a triage look where we're going out and talking to legislative members, we're talking to agencies, we're talking to LFO and BAM, and we're trying to get a sense for those particular program areas which are the most important. And we gather all that information, we come up with a list much too long to ever be able to do all the audit work we think we need to do, and we try to whittle it down based on risk to those areas that seem to be the most important for us to undertake. So from a performance point of view, that is almost entirely risk-based, and we go into them looking for the sort of things like economy, efficiency, and program results. And of course, those are reported broadly. I think I've got about 3 minutes here left now. Kind of the national challenges. Standards seem to be coming out all the time, and how we go about implementing those and the workload it does mean for us is critical. even though Sarbanes-Oxley, which was the result of some of the scandals in the private sector, those sorts of things are being applied to the private sector, they've trickled down to the government sector. I mean, a lot of the things that they were talking about make good business sense, whether you're in the private or the public sector. So that we are starting to see things show up in some of the government accounting standards, some of the government auditing standards that are more requirements around identifying fraud and evaluation of controls and some more broad reporting of some of those things. So that does mean more workload for us, which we're happy to do if that's what folks want. And this again was one of those 1997 quotes, but really what it's getting to is that it's about accountability. People still want accountability. That without good public accountability, the sort of information that we're providing and kind of become the engine for a lot of decision making, if it's not trusted information, it just causes a problem. So that's policymakers, program authors, how well agencies perform against expectations, and we're starting to see a lot of that today, even in discussions we'll have this legislative session is around how do we increase accountability. One of the bills you'll be hearing on Thursday, it came specifically out of accountability issues. How does the legislature get the information they need to help make decisions? And that'll be an interesting discussion. I hope to be here for that one, because we're in the accountability business in large measure together, and how each entity can fit and support the other is important if we're going to make a model for Oregon that allows everybody to do their part and is filling all the information needs. So that'll be an interesting discussion on Thursday. Specific to Oregon, our challenge is just it's a balancing act. I mean, really, we've got mandated audits. We've got things that we want to do. We've got a balancing act, and we decide exactly how we're going to apply our resources. About 60% of what we do, we consider coming out of the mandatory category. You add in our financial audits and the sort of things we find in statute, which really aren't financial, but still is work that we need to do. That leaves us about 40% to do some of the more discretionary things, and that continues to get impinged upon, not in a bad way, but as the hotline that we handle seems to be increasing in popularity. I don't know what that means, but we seem to be getting more and more business. More and more of our resources are going towards those activities. I mean, they're important that we handle those. And what used to be 1.5 FTE 3 years ago, we now got 4 folks. And we didn't get more staff for that. In fact, last budget session, I'm not crying here, but we actually lost a couple positions, so we're trying to do the same or more with less. So, it is a balancing act, and we're trying to do as many different parts of the business as we can and get smarter about some things and still continue the same level of service we've been able to provide otherwise. And I think that we can probably stop there if you'd like. I mean, there isn't much more to say, and we can just handle questions.
Great. Representative Thatcher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate all the work that the Audits Division does, and I've seen the reports, and I've seen some pretty critical, analyses of different agencies and even suggestions on what could be changed to maybe come in line with a similar agency nationwide, or how much money could be saved if they should implement a certain procedure.
Mm-hmm.
However, seems like it stops there. I don't really see some of these suggestions being run with. Is that just a matter of us as legislators that we have to push the agencies to implement these suggestions that you come up with?
Chair Riley.
The answer is yes on that, I believe.
Yes, that's very true. Chair Riley, Representative Thatcher, we have the power of the pen would be the extent of it. I mean, we're not a regulatory agency, so we go out independently, we evaluate, we make recommendations, we report it. We'll follow up on those recommendations and report that back in terms of a percentage basis, but if there's particular things you would be interested in, we can certainly get that information for you as well. I've got a database where we keep all of our recommendations to follow up on them and see how much progress is being made. At this point in time, over 80%, 85% of the recommendations we make are being implemented within the first year. Some of them are just frankly longer term than 1 year, so it's taking some time for them to get going. But there are some that will go unimplemented, and so I guess answering the question is in some measure probably you're asking questions about recommendations we made may inspire as much or more action as what we're able to inspire.
I guess a follow-up to that. I'm sorry. Is that what this bill we're going to be talking about Thursday, where we create an Office of Program Policy Analysis and Government Accountability within the Legislative Fiscal Office is about, where they can actually interface with some of these audits and what's happened?
I think we need to wait until Thursday and
okay, well,
get
I just,
into that because...
That's fine.
Don't spoil the surprise.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I just would like to see a lot of these good suggestions that they make in their reports be implemented. And, you know, it's
well,
going to be a waste otherwise.
And I think, if I may, that if we see that recommendations that you have made are not being followed, it's incumbent upon us to do something about that. We can certainly pass regulations and laws which require those to be put in if we think they're right.
Mm-hmm. Representative, if I might add in that regard, I believe I'm right about this, that with each budget that they submit this session, there is a part of that where they list findings that both we've had, that the feds have had, and you know, whoever, and that they're supposed to be reporting back what they have done with those particular findings. So they should be in some way captured in their budget and being reported to you folks. So I believe that exists.
Okay.
And if not, if you had somebody in mind, give me a call.
This is just kind of a little bit of a follow-up, and please forgive me, I'm new, so this might be something obvious to the rest of the committee, but when I was here in 93, one of the common complaints with agencies was that when they got towards the end of the biennium, they tend to spend a fair amount of their budget towards the end to justify the fact that when the new biennium came out that they could get the full set of money.
Mm-hmm.
Is that evaluated in your accountability when you go through and look for how accountable an agency is?
Chair Riley, Representative Girard. We have done some work around that issue because that we had the perception that that was a risk as well.
Mm-hmm.
Initially, and it certainly is still out there, it was just a lower risk than what we originally thought. We did some, with the wonderful tools we've now got for information technology, we were able to take expenditure data, you know, for all of the majority of the state. We did some analysis on spending patterns. We even went out and asked some questions around, you know, why? You know, why were you buying 20 computers in May? And you know, and a lot of the answers that we got back were, well, you know, we weren't sure whether we were going to have the money until May, but you know, we certainly needed the computers, and so, you know, through those sorts of discussions, that sort of analysis, not to say that doesn't exist, but we found it to be a lesser risk than what we had thought when we first did some of the risk analysis around that. So we certainly, to answer your question directly, I guess yes, we have considered that and done some work in that area.
Okay.
And that's I guess in a nutshell.
Representative Edwards.
Chair Riley. Thank you. Could you speak briefly to the experience of your auditors? Are they required to be CPAs, the pay scale of the auditors and how it compares to private sector and
mm-hmm.
a little bit?
Chair Riley, Representative Edwards. Experience-wise, we are very much of an advocate for our folks to be certified in some measure. I'd say probably 60% to 65% of our folks have either a CPA or a master's. We have performance auditors, so the CPA isn't necessarily as relevant as an MPA or an MBA. So we try to inspire folks to do that. Part of the reason that we don't have more is we've got a fairly young staff. We've been experiencing some turnover for some time, and we need 3 years of experience beyond passing a CPA to be able to become a CPA. So if you've got fairly young staff, most of them are working on it, but they haven't gotten the requisite experience. I think it's 2 years, but it takes about three before they really are able to touch all the experience bases they needed to touch. So that's what we're striving for. Right now we've got, like I say, 60-65% of our staff either hold the MBA or the CPA. All of our managers and our senior in charges have some version of that, with the exception of maybe one. So that's the sort of staff that we have. Our accumulated experience, if you were to take it on we've got on average 5.4 years of experience, and that's up for us. We've been tracking that. We went through a period where we were losing staff fairly regularly, the private sector, thanks to Sarbanes-Oxley and other things. I mean, we've got some very talented people that could go to work for more money other places. And to be able to build that back up has been critical to us, because we are in the people business. And in terms of pay scale, one of the things that we did do in this past interim was we were able to have a salary analysis done and adjust some of the salaries to be more competitive with the private sector. And I think in part that's helped with some of the retention issues, to be able to keep our kind of the middle group, that 3 to 5 year experience group, connected to the office, so we can continue to grow that experience. So we're within 10% of what was in the last salary survey that allowed us to adjust our salaries to be more competitive with those that were regularly taking our staff.
Well, thank you very much for the information that you provided, and I'm sure we'll be seeing you again. And with that,
yes,
I'm
definitely
going to close this hearing. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2076.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2076 authorizes the State Landscape Contractors Board to issue probationary landscape contractor licenses and expands the options for meeting minimum education and experience requirements for being licensed as a landscape contractor.
Thank you, Patrick. And we have one person who wants to testify. Mike, would you come up and provide your name? And
thank you. Chair Riley and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mike Snyder. I am the current administrator for the Landscape Contractors Board. I'm also a licensed landscape contractor. I have been that for the last 30 years and have moved over to the administration of the Landscape Contractors Board. House Bill 2076, we are pleased that it's in the packet of streamlining bills. It is a policy change for the Landscape Contractors Board. Currently, the law requires that a person or an individual that is going to take the examination for the Landscape Contractors license needs to have different experience and education requirements in order to get that license. Over the years, that has been seen as a little bit restrictive to the entrance into the industry, and what the board has decided to do in communication with other agencies or other business entities, especially the construction contractors, is to allow any person to come in and take the exam if they don't have the experience or the education requirements, give them 1 year to pass all the sections of the exam. If that individual passes those sections of the exam and do not have any business experience in the construction industry, they will be issued a probationary license, which will allow them then either to do one of three things. That individual can go work for a licensed landscaping business that already exists and work under the direct supervision of a non-probationary landscape contractor for a 2 year period, so they gain experience. Or they can start their own landscaping business. If they do that, then they will be required to obtain a $15,000 bond, and the amount of projects, the cost of the projects that they're allowed to do will not exceed $15,000 for a 2 year period, which allows them to get more experience and gives better consumer protection. They also can become employed by a landscaping business as a supervising landscape contractor, but that business will have to have a $15,000 bond, and the size of the projects will be $15,000 or less, and that for a 2 year period. If the individual that takes the exam has 2 years experience with the Construction Contractors Board as a licensed construction contracting business, that individual then can open a business and work normally as we do now. Take any questions you have.
Seeing no questions, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Does anyone else wish to speak on this bill? If not, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2076, and I'm going to open the work session on House Bill 2076. Is there any discussion about this bill?
It's pretty straightforward today.
I'm kind of hesitating while he goes and finds someone who might want to vote.
Oh, that might be a good idea.
Yeah.
I appreciate your verbal frugality. Oh, I like that word, frugality.
We'll give him an opportunity to vote later.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I would like to move House Bill 2076 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Beyer has moved that we move the House Bill 2076 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any objection? Seeing none, it's ordered.
Did you want to carry it?
Yes. Before I close this work session, I'm going to assign this to Representative Thatcher to carry. Thank you. And so I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2076, and I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2077. Do you want to give us a rundown on that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2077 exempts landscape businesses that subgrant contract for the construction of project site features to licensed construction contractors from requirements that they be licensed as construction contractors. It imposes restrictions and conditions on businesses claiming that exemption. And it exempts construction contractors that subcontract project landscaping to licensed landscape contractors from requirements that they be licensed as landscaping businesses. I should mention, Mr. Chair, also, sorry I didn't mention this for the last one, we have received, maybe you have a copy of it in front of you, both this bill and the previous bill, although the staff measure summary says the statement has not yet been issued, we did receive a minimal fiscal impact statement for both this measure and the previous measure.
I did see it. Thank you. Mike, you want to come back up and tell us what you think about this one?
Thank you, Chair Riley and members of the committee. Again, my name for the record is Mike Snyder. I'm the administrator for the Landscape Contractors Board. This bill, I have a few more comments on this bill, if you would allow me the time. This bill is very important to the landscape industry, and we're happy to see it as a streamlining bill because it does streamline. The intent of this bill is to streamline the number of licenses that a landscape business or construction business has to have in order to complete a landscape project or construction project for the consumer. It also simplifies the contract requirements for a consumer in dealing with the projects that are in place for them. And they can do the landscape project under one contract, and they can also do the complete construction project under one contract. This bill allows a subcontracting ability to a landscape business to enter into subcontracts with a licensed construction contractor to perform work outside of the scope of the license of the landscaping business. So currently, landscaping businesses have certain scope of work that they can do. They would like the ability to subcontract to licensed construction contractors to perform work that are related to the landscape project. For instance, a in-ground spa or a swimming pool, where they, as a landscape architect, designs the project, includes these features into the project, and the landscaping business right now cannot, by law, subcontract to a construction contractor to do that work. The consumer would have to contract with the construction contractor. So he would have at least two or three or more contracts that they would have in order to get the project completed. It also allows, vice versa, allows construction contractors the ability to subcontract to licensed landscaping businesses to perform landscape work on projects, which is not currently in the scope of license of a construction contractor. So it works both ways. It creates a prohibition for landscaping businesses to hire or to subcontract to unlicensed entities, and it also creates a prohibition for construction contractors to enter into contracts with unlicensed landscaping businesses, which has happened many times in the past. The thing that I want to really point out to you, the difference is here that a landscaping business is different than a construction business. We have a two-license system for the landscaping business. The landscaping business, I don't want to lose you in my comments here, and so I'm going to try to be as concise as I can be. If you have questions, please interrupt me. A landscaping business, in order to operate in the state of Oregon, has to either employ or be owned by a licensed individual landscape contractor. That's an individual that is hired or is the owner that is to directly supervise all the landscape operations of that business. So we have an individual that's licensed, and we also have a business that's licensed, therefore the two-license system. Now, the individual is the important person here in the sense that that individual takes an exam on laws and rules, on contracts, on liens, on insurance requirements, everything that surrounds how to operate a business in the state of Oregon and the laws that guide it. How to subcontract, how to do all these things. Very similar to what the construction contractors currently have for their people that become licensed general contractors. However, on top of that, the individual has to take a competency exam to demonstrate how to install decks, how to install a water feature, how to install a retaining wall, how to plant lawns, trees, shrubs, and nursery stock, how to install an irrigation system. It is a competency exam that they're required to take in order to become licensed. Currently, there is no competency exam for trade practices with the construction contractor's license. All they have is that business license, and they become licensed as general contractors. Landscaping businesses currently today do subcontract for work that's within the scope of their license. Their scope of their license does allow the business to install decks, fences, water features, you know, construction-related items. We have an exemption from the construction law to allow landscaping businesses to install these things. Some businesses make the business decision that, you know, we have enough to do without installing the deck or without installing the walkway or the driveway. We're going to hire another business, landscaping business, or another construction contracting business to do that work. We have that ability to do that today. However, what we're looking for is things outside of that which are related to the site features for a landscaping business. It's not about building homes, about taking anything away from general contractors and what they're doing and building a house that's lived in by people. It's talking about the site features related to the landscape project, like having an electrician wire in the pump for the water feature. Can't do that today. Many landscaping businesses do not realize today that they are not allowed to subcontract to these construction contractors, because many of them do it already, but the law has not been enforced. And vice versa, many general contractors, construction contractors, do not realize that they're not allowed to subcontract to landscaping businesses to do the landscape work on their projects. That also has not been enforced. This bill corrects all that. Okay? We are trying to make it legislatively possible, statutory authority, to allow this cooperation to work between landscaping businesses and the construction businesses to get the project done under one contract and to simplify how this is all done. We think the bill makes sense.
Thank you. Representative Thatcher.
You looked at me like you knew I'd have a question here. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just for the record, I'm the principal of a business that is licensed through this Construction Contractors Board. But I just can't, I'm shocked because, yeah, you're right. Where does it come? That means that every ODOT project out there that ever installed trees, I mean, that you got Wildish and Hamilton and Kiewit and all those people out there violating the law. Is that what you're saying?
Representative Riley, Representative Thatcher, yes, that would be if you would read the law. Now let me explain, Chair Riley, Representative Thatcher. The Landscape Contractors Board started in 1971. You know, the legislature carved out this little world for landscape work from the construction work. 1985, we became administered. The board became administered by the Construction Contractors Board. Now, you can see if you're administered by the board that you are also regulating in another area, the confusion between construction and landscape was not really clearly defined. And so what was looked at through the law was looked at from the construction contractor side. Now, I'm not blaming anybody. I'm not saying anything. And the law was not read in its entirety. So we determined, as I said, landscaping businesses have not been able to, by law, subcontract to electricians to install that pump or to install the electrical wiring to that pump. They didn't know that. CCB's never enforced it. Likewise, the Landscape Contracting Board has never enforced it the other way around. So that's already there. We had an Assistant Attorney General review our laws to see if that was correct, and it is correct. And so it's like, okay, you know, why can't we get this straightened out so that it makes sense for everybody? And, you know, it's not that the Landscape Contractors Board is looking to go out and fine every construction contractor. Likewise, we don't want the Construction Contractors Board going out and fining our members either to that extreme. This makes sense to me, or to the board, I won't say me directly, and to the industry. And we would like to correct it. And we've taken the initiative to introduce this bill to do that. It's a shock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you clarify, you addressed my question that I'm about to ask you, but I'm not sure that I understood it.
Sure.
You said there's currently the two license system, the business is licensed and the individual owner or manager of the business is licensed. I mean, can somebody currently own a landscaping business, but they're not actually, they're just the owners?
Yes.
And they don't have to have a competency to do the work themselves.
Chair Riley, Representative Edwards, you're exactly correct.
And that's under the current system.
Current system,
okay,
allows a, for you, for example, take you, for example, you want to start a landscaping business. You could do that without taking any exam of any sort. You would need to employ a licensed individual landscape contractor that has demonstrated, passed the exam.
Right.
Okay. That would be required to supervise the landscape operations of your business and directly supervise any unlicensed employees that are performing the landscape work.
Follow-up question.
This bill does not change that. Is that correct?
Does not change that.
Okay. That was my follow-up question. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you very much for listening.
And I'm going to call a panel. John Dinges, John Stone, Galista, and Bill Cross. I know how to say one of those names. Come on up.
John.
Mr. Chair, committee members, what I'll do is introduce the Landscape Contractors Association, so speak, and I'll move out of the way so that the actual landscape contractors can share a couple of comments with you. But I'm here for the record. My name is Bill Cross, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Landscape Contractors Association. And I've passed. Oops. I have a written statement. Sorry. The association was apprised of this legislative proposal during the interim when Mr. Snyder brought it to our attention that the Landscape Contractors Board had the governor's approval to go ahead and submit this legislation. The board reviewed it, and we are very supportive. This issue actually came up in 2005, halfway through the session, when it was determined that a landscape contractor could not function as a as a general contractor if they were going to use a general CCB licensed contractor for a portion of that landscaping work. And we're talking about landscaping work. And there was a Department of Justice, I believe, Deputy Attorney General, that said they can't do that. We tried to amend the bill, and it was moving so far along we couldn't get the amendment in. So Mr. Snyder's brought it up in the interim, during which the opinion came down from CCB's Attorney General, I believe, also that, well, oops, there is a problem. General construction contractors can't subcontract with licensed landscape contractors. And years ago, they used to be all one entity. And it was about 6 or 7 years ago that the Landscape Contractors Board that was a part of Construction Contractors Board was pulled out as a separate semi-independent agency with its own board. And I think maybe somewhere along there is maybe when some of this confusion occurred. So life's been going on for the most part, and we've got contractors of both kinds that have been thinking they could be doing this work, and when it related, they could, you know, bring in another contractor who was licensed to do that work, as part of the overall project. So we're finding out that can't be done, and we would really appreciate your support in this legislation. Bottom line is the consumer, the owner, the building owner, homeowner, the benefits of dealing with a general contractor, one contractor who can coordinate then the work of all the subs, making sure that they're on the appropriate days when the projects are ready for their particular work on the project, is more cost effective for the owner and a lot less headaches for the owner. So I'll step out of the way and allow these gentlemen to maybe give you a little of the practical, you know, some practical examples of what this bill would help address.
Thank you for your time and consideration. My name is John Stone. I'm the owner of J.P. Stone Contractors, a licensed landscaping firm in the Portland area. One of the areas that I'm also the current president of the Oregon Landscape Contractors Association. One of the practical areas where this new law change would apply is in residential work, where you're dealing with a homeowner who's not a professional in any allied construction-related area, wants to get maybe some sort of a fairly complicated project done on the outside of their house. They're faced with hiring multiple contractors if they wanted to have a gas barbecue or a gas fireplace built in their backyard along with a patio and irrigation system and plantings. Maybe an electrical connection is needed for some of these things. Gas connection is needed for these things. It's work that we can't do. We have to go back to the homeowner and say, well, you have to find somebody to do these aspects of the work. If they say they want to go to a general contractor to do all of the work, that doesn't work. I mean, technically, they can't hire us to do the landscape portion. And that's an area that the typical general contractor isn't that familiar with. It creates a problem for the homeowners. It creates a problem for responsibility. If there's some problem on the job, who's responsible for what? You have several contractors, several bonds, several insurance companies. This isn't the type of situation that the average homeowner wants to face. they want to be able to go to one person and say, look, you did everything on the property. I expect you to take care of it. And that's the way it should be for. It has a similar application in some commercial situations, but frequently with commercial you're dealing, there's some other licensed professionals involved that can sort it out. But with the homeowner, it's confusing and it puts them in a position that they're not comfortable. Thank you.
My name is John Dinges, Mr. Chair. I am one of those people that have both licenses, and I have both just because of this situation. And believe me, it gets very confusing when you're telling the homeowner that part of this project you're using one license and one bond, and another part of this project we're using the other license and bond in order to complete it. It's the same as John has said and Mike. It's very confusing. And we would also really like to be in compliance with the law when we work for a general contractor. And I can see lawsuits being a real problem if this ever comes to a head.
When you say you're one of those people who hold both licenses, you don't mean that you hold a business license and a landscaping license. You mean you hold a contractor's license and a landscaper's license. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, Chair Riley, committee, thank you for your time. My name is John Galissa. I own Professional Grounds Management. We've been in business for 12 years in the Portland metro area. I hold both landscape business and landscape contractor's license for my company. And upon passing my test, kind of reiterating what Mike said, is I took the business portion of the test and proved that I could execute contracts and operate as a business in this realm. And it would be best for my customers and for my business to be able to offer these as a single person on the job.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Would Greg Miller come to the stand, please? Thank you, Greg.
Thank you, Chair Riley, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Greg Miller with the Associated General Contractors, and I'd like to register several concerns that we have with the bill before you today, 2077. First of all, the perceived notion that a general contractor is somehow prohibited from contracting with a landscape contractor raises several concerns for me. I know many of my members perform that task. They do it by the direction of state agencies. So if that's the case, slap the cuffs on us and take us to jail, because as of now, I'm unaware of a statutory prohibition of providing those services to state agencies or other private owners. Here today, talk specifically about the construction sector and the differences that there are there. In the commercial construction sector, it's not uncommon to have plumbers, electricians, and other trades licensed in that trade, and then also licensed as a general contractor with the Construction Contractors Board. Conversations that I've had with my members, it's not an owner's requirement. The cost is de minimis, and the process to get that license is not overly burdensome. In fact, several of AGC members that have landscaping businesses also hold general contractor licenses with the CCB as a licensed trade profession and also as a general contractor. I understand the concept, the residential component that the Landscape Contractors Board pursuing with this bill, but the way that the bill is written, there's no limitation on the amount of work that a landscape contractor could do with a landscape contractor license. And in that, I mean the construction of very large, very complicated public parks, public open spaces, and then on the private side, the same as well. That when you get into the public arena, public contracting and prevailing wage, it's a very complicated system. And to be licensed with the Construction Contractors Board gives the avenue for an owner to come back to a contractor and say, you are a contractor on this issue, I'm coming after you for any damages that or any construction defects that happened on a specific project. And there's a place to go to. It's not an exempted class of contractor that is a different association. again, many agencies hold the dual licensure, and AGC just has some concerns with this bill and would like to have those addressed. So, happy to take any questions.
Representative Thatcher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm a little confused on, it sounds like there are similar requirements as far as getting licensed, you know, for the, do you know how to contract, do you know about liens and all that, but in addition to what the contractors board requires, the landscapers board requires competency in landscaping in addition to that. Is that not a correct statement?
I couldn't speak to the landscape contractor's specific test. I've not seen that, nor have I seen the CCB test, but I know that the CCB test is specific to business practices, specific to Oregon law, public contracting law, lien laws. It's more of a test geared towards being a general contractor and not a trade license as the landscape contractors.
Could I? Is there somebody maybe who would know the answer to that question?
Oh. Yes.
If it's the
yes.
same
Mike, you want to come up and help us with that? Tell us your name again for the record.
Chair Riley, for the record, and members of the committee, my name is Mike Snyder. I'm the current administrator for the Landscape Contractors Board. We have seven sections of our exam. The first section of the exam is the laws and rules and business practice section of our exam. That includes all the laws, Oregon laws, and rules that are related to landscape work in the state of Oregon, about liens, how to do contracts, how to enter into contracts, insurance requirements, bonding requirements, all those things that are required of a business to operate in the state of Oregon. It's very similar to the construction contractors exam, where they take a 16-hour class and then take a test, I think it's even an open book test, where they're, take that test, and then get their construction contractor's license. There's no competency requirement for the construction contractor's license. We have an additional requirement for the landscape contractor.
Can I answer your question?
Well, okay, just to make sure I understand, Mr. Chair, that I'm hearing that there's similar... Basically, the license says they both cover laws, rules, business practices, insurance, bonding, all of that stuff. They both cover that. But in addition to the contractor's license, a landscape licensee would have to also demonstrate competency.
That is correct.
I have a question.
Representative Griffin. Yes, this actually goes to both. Because I'm like Representative Thatcher, I'm a little bit confused now. But my question was the problem with the scope of the projects that are allowed. You stated that you wanted to see some restrictions and some more definitive language. Is that is there an amendment or something that you would suggest to this bill? And then I'd like the counter argument to that, as if that's relevant.
Chair Riley, Representative Durrad, that is definitely a direction that we could go. I don't have an amendment prepared, but the leeway in the bill is not specific to any limitations. It simply says site features mean surfaces, steps, trellises, benches, water features, spas, ponds, waterways, pools, gazebos, small sheds for storing garden tools, and other physical elements of the landscape that are not within the scope of landscape and business license. And that to me is an open book on the amount of work and the size of projects that the landscapers could take on that would otherwise be taken on by general contractors who are familiar with contracting with electricians, plumbers, concrete contractors, all sorts of trade contractors that construct those kinds of facilities. But if it's the pleasure of the committee, we'd be happy to work on an amendment to the bill.
Chair Riley, Representative Durrad. we don't think there should be any limitation on the work for site features for a landscape project. I beg the question a little bit here in terms of a person that takes the CCB license automatically gets an unended amount of work that they can do with just a business practice law. They have nothing that demonstrates that they know how to do any of this. And yet they're allowed to go out and do any amount without any competency. Landscape contractors are required to take competency. They at least know how a deck's supposed to be attached to the house. They at least know how to know a retaining wall is built, how to install the water feature, all the aspects of construction that they're relating to. They are tested on. They pass it. I think they're better qualified to perform that work, to make the arguments.
Something that you just said, and I want to ask you a specific question. Is there anything in the testing that relates to the envelope of a house?
Chair Riley.
Sure.
The only thing that relates to the envelope of the house is the deck, how the deck is attached to the house, and how the flashing is supposed to be, and how it's all incorporated, and how it's attached. And that's what's there.
To prevent moisture
intrusion. Prevent moisture into the house, yes.
Okay. Any follow-up on that?
I'm a little confused.
Okay. I'm going to ask you to have a small work group and try to come back to this committee with some amendment or agreement before we proceed. And thank you both for your testimony. And is there anyone else who would like to testify? Scott, come on up.
Hi, for the record, Scott Berry with the Oregon Home Builders Association, and we have a few concerns as well. It's not a new issue for our association, for the landscape contractors. It's something that came up a little bit last session. We had some meetings in the interim, I think our concern right now is a couple of things. One, while it's true today that after the competency, after the CCB testing, is completed and is business related, that there's no additional testing. But as some of you already are aware, that is no longer going to be true after this session. So after this session, we will have not only continuing ed for construction contractors, very likely, but also a certification of the building envelope separate from the continuing ed for all sorts of folks who are involved in the who have construction contractors license and who are involved in the envelope of the house. And that's I won't go into the details on that. You're welcome to sit in on the consumer protection committee that where most of that stuff will be headed, as the chair I know currently serves. But I think how those new rules and those new regulations affect our industry, and how the new landscape contractors rules will affect us is something we want to spend a little bit more time talking about with the landscape folks. You know, currently our bond is higher than theirs today. They're proposing to fix this, that in this bill. We're certainly supportive of that, giving the consumer more protection under that new bond and raising up to the level that our bond is today, although our bond is going up as well, potentially this session from there. So I think there's just a lot of integration involved here between the two industries, and I think how that all fits together.
Can we back just a little from the microphone?
I think how all that fits together will sort of determine our support for this bill, or our concerns, or certainly clarify the concerns that we may have. But we've been working together, and we're certainly hoping to find a solution to this.
Any questions? Representative Thatcher.
Sorry, you mentioned that the bond and liability insurance requirements are different. I guess I don't remember what they are. What's the difference?
Currently, for a construction contractor, general contractor, it's $15,000, I believe, moving to $20,000 potentially this session. And with the addition of, again, potentially, depending on the legislation, a separate fund for consumers based on civil penalties that are brought in. And again, it's difficult for me to talk in specifics, because that's all legislation, much like this is.
But currently,
we are at $15,000, and I believe this bill moves them to $15,000, if I'm not mistaken.
Representative Grant.
Yes.
Thank you, Chair Riley. I have a question because there's some confusion for me. I thought one of the cruxes of the bill was to make it so landscape they could negotiate with general contractors and vice versa. So it seemed to me like it would be a good deal, bill for general contractors if they could contract with the landscape people. So, are you saying that parts of the bill are okay, or does that from the other person that sounded like that they were unaware that that problem even existed? So,
Chair Riley, Representative Garrard, I think that today, as we look at the bill, we're fine with probably most of it. We do have some concerns about the way we're moving with new construction contractor regulations, bonding requirements, and specifically some of the requirements on envelope training.
Okay.
For the construction contractor, and then again the way that a landscape person would be licensed, bonded, and then trained in that same category, because of course if they're going to do decks, that may be there's some conflict there in terms of if they can do decking if this additional legislation passes, and that's just based on a certification that would be required, and you have to get a construction contractor to get that certification. So that came out of the Construction Claims Task Force, which I think has been working for about 16 months now on trying to help us solve some of the problems in construction claims. And then, in addition, if I just might add to that, I think the problem for us, just to clarify this issue on the decking, is if, as a general contractor, I build a house in 2007, and 2 years later, a landscape contractor is hired to put a deck on. That deck then breaks the envelope of the house. 5 years later, water seeps in, causes mold, causes other problems. The person who's going to get the call is the general contractor. The person who's going to get the lawsuit is the general contractor who built the house. And then it will be incumbent upon them to prove that the water intrusion then potentially came from that deck that they had nothing to do with. And so somehow getting through that process and the certification and the education from those completely different processes, I guess, in terms of where we are today with construction contracting and where we're going and where landscape contractors are today is a bit complicated, and I just... I would like to work through that process instead of having a bill passed that then is affected by another bill passing a month later.
One quick follow-up. Hang on. Scott, I'm going to ask you to join the work group, and I'm also going to ask Pat Allen to join your work group. And Representative Thatcher, would you also join that work group?
Happy to.
Thank you. And I'm going to give you about a week and a half. If you guys can come to some agreement, great. If not, I'm going to move the bill. So with that, I'm going to give you your one question if you still have it. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2077, and I'm going to close the session on the... a committee for today, and we will do you want to vote on 2076? I can allow that.
I thought it was the previous
one. The one we voted on while you were gone. How do we hear that? Yes, we heard that, and we voted on it while you were out of the room.
Wow.
I'm actually going to reopen the work session on House Bill 2076 to allow Representative Edwards to vote on that. And
Mr. Chair, members, if I may, I think the procedure that we to go forward on this is a member, the chair, or a member of the committee can make a motion to suspend the rules to allow Representative Edwards to cast a vote on that bill.
I will move that we suspend the rules to allow Representative Edwards to vote on this bill with no objections. So ordered.
Thank you.
How would you like to vote on that bill?
I'd like to vote yes.
Thank you. Record will show that Representative voted yes, and I'm going to end the work session on House Bill 2076 and end the Committee for Government Accountability and Information Technology for today. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you.